This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun Teik. Work is a central part of most adults' identities. In today's economy, some of us work too much, while others struggle to put together a decent living. A new book called The Refusal of Work, Rethinking Post-Work Theory and Practice, documents a third group who is choosing to work less. Author David Frayne writes about the lived experiences of people coping in a society which believes work is good for you. David joins me now on the line from the UK. A lot of books today are proclaiming the end of work as we know it or are forecasting the rise of the machines. What is the argument put forth in your book?
There is a kind of history of work that is kind of forecasting the end of work, or as you said, the rise of machines. And I suppose I'm interested in this idea that automation might be eliminating a certain proportion of jobs. And in a capitalist system, that's obviously bad news because it throws people into unemployment where they become socially isolated and maybe in poverty. So the question I'm interested in is, does automation also have a positive side if we can somehow harness it to give us more free time? In a different social system, could automation be a good thing because it gives us more free time to kind of do the things that we want to do, rather than in the present system where it kind of casts people out of work and it is something to be feared?
So you are a sociologist by training, and you start the book by going through some of the theories of how we've thought about work in the past. How have our ideas of work changed over time?
I guess one thing that the book tries to tap into is what I kind of perceive to be a real disillusionment with paid work in the present. You know, the book features interviews with people who are trying to kind of reconfigure the relationship with work by either working less or maybe giving up work altogether for a period.
Yeah, you call it resisting work.
Yeah, resisting work. You know, and I guess I would say that this isn't really, I mean, I can't speak for Malaysia, but in the UK, my feeling is that this isn't a particularly unique thing. I think there are a lot of people feeling this kind of disillusionment with their jobs, trying to kind of define their identities around other activities apart from work. So maybe one of the ways our feelings about work have changed is this kind of widespread disillusionment that the book sort of picks up on and tries to kind of tap into and understand.
Can you tell us a little bit about the people you have interviewed and write about in the book, people who have actively tried not to make work a central part of their life?
Yeah, so there's lots of different reasons why they've done this. Some people were unwell and didn't feel able to work. But most people complained in some way about the jobs that they'd done. So maybe their jobs were kind of repetitive and stressful, or maybe they felt like the jobs were kind of requiring too much of them emotionally. Or maybe they had this kind of nagging feeling that, you know, the roles that they were forced to kind of adopt on a daily basis didn't really express who they were, and they didn't have enough time in their lives to do the things that they wanted to do. And I guess that's a really common feeling in modern society. But I think what made these people unique was that they acted upon that feeling, and they tried to resist work. They tried to give themselves more free time. But what I will say about these people is that for the most part, they were kind of failing to do this, because the ability to resist work, you know, requires resources. It might require financial resources to allow you to survive with a lower income. It might require emotional resources to be able to kind of live with that feeling of social disconnection and stigma that often comes if you're not working. So I was kind of interested to explore, you know, what are the pleasures of their lives and what are some of the problems of their lives? And can we learn anything by looking at their values?
I was just about to ask you how much of their decision is brought upon by this notion of the sharing or the gig economy, because people are forced into doing more freelance work or jobs without stable income?
Yeah, so again, I guess this ties back into the idea that the ability to refuse work is almost a kind of privilege in a way, because the problem that a lot of us face in the present is actually just not being able to find anyone who can give us a job. You know, this is certainly my problem. So people are feeling kind of, I don't know, work in the kind of gig economy is not really a reliable thing to kind of rest your identity on, because it is something that we have and then we don't have. And it's quite sort of risky to build your identity around a job that you may not have in a year's time, for example.
And that is another point that you make in the book, right? That our identity, so much of our adult life, is formed by our relationship to our job. And you're saying this is not necessarily a healthy thing?
I don't know if it's not a healthy thing. Well, I guess I'm thinking about, you know, when you go to a party, for example, the first thing that someone says to you is, what do you do? And when they ask you, what do? They're asking you about work. And we always say to children, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? When we ask them what they want to be, we're kind of asking them about jobs, like what jobs do they want to do when they're older? And it's not so much that I think this is unhealthy, but I think this kind of elevation of work as this kind of main centerpiece of people's identities is kind of risky in a society where work is becoming more discontinuous. You know, the gig economy, a lot of jobs are not very satisfying or secure. So I think it's not so much that building your identity around work is unhealthy, but it's more kind of risky now in a society where, I don't know, enjoyable, secure work is becoming more and more rare and more of a privilege.
Just to go back on what you said before this about the feelings of disillusionment that people feel towards their work, this notion that one should pursue one's passion and combine it with your vocation is very attractive. But correct me if I'm wrong, you say this is a fantasy?
So the idea of your kind of paid work being your passion and your vocation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess a lot of these questions kind of have a very personal resonance for me. I enjoy teaching and I want to be a university lecturer. And sometimes I am when I can find the work, and sometimes I'm not. And I guess there's this feeling among myself and a lot of my peers that paid work is an increasingly unsuitable arena for us to kind of live out our kind of creative and vocational ambitions, because it's so hard to find work. And then often when you do find it, it's organized in such a way that you can't really kind of creatively express yourself, or it's not quite what you expected it to be. My feeling is that there are a lot of young people particularly feeling that paid work is an increasingly unsuitable arena to kind of live out their creative ambitions, and trying to find ways to live those out in other areas of life instead.
Continuing on that theme, across the world in universities, there is a tendency to relegate the humanities or the liberal arts in preference for STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And this, I guess, is because more science and engineering jobs are required by the economy. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it makes me quite sad in a way, the idea that the value of education is equivalent to its usefulness for things like economic growth and producing kind of employable students. You know, there's a lot that's valuable about education that can't be expressed in that way and that can't be quantified. And I think, you know, the humanities and the social sciences, you know, they can do so much. They can, you know, they can teach the value of democracy, and they can improve our kind of emotional literacy and help us to understand the world. So I suppose I do find it quite sad that the value of education and the value of particular subjects is increasingly kind of measured in terms of whether they can contribute to economic growth or to employability. So I guess I would really stick up for the arts and humanities.
I'm speaking today to David Frayne about his book, The Refusal of Work. I'll ask him what he thinks about the universal basic income after the break. You're listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. My guest today is David Frayne, author of The Refusal of Work, Rethinking Post-Work Theory and Practice. What are your thoughts on this idea of a guaranteed basic income?
Yeah, so guaranteed basic income is something that I am still learning about. So it's not something I would kind of confidently defend in any detail. But I think it is a really interesting idea. In relation to something I was saying earlier, I think one of the things that motivated the book is just this sense that there's so much kind of wasted talent and energy in society. Because to be able to do productive work, for the most part, we have to have a paid job in order to kind of fund our lives. And I think there are a lot of people without work or between work or doing insecure work who are just kind of, they're outside employment, but they're not really able to do much productive with their time because they're facing poverty and stigma. And we just have this tremendous kind of wastage of talent in society, just kind of inactive people. And I suppose one of the interesting things about guaranteed basic income is that it would fund people who are outside work or between jobs to kind of do something useful and valuable with their time. You know, we'd be able to spend time outside of work doing something kind of productive, maybe setting up something in our community or doing kind of artistic projects, or, you know, we might be funded to kind of spend more time with our children. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite interested in that idea of a basic income as a way of, I guess, you know, helping people to express their kind of talents and abilities even when they're outside of work.
So the only country who has seriously considered it is Switzerland, and they put it to a vote and it was comprehensively defeated. Less than 30% of the Swiss people voted for it. Critics say this is a form of welfare. The argument would be that we've got a glimpse of what happens if you remove the incentive to work. Do you see any alternatives?
Yeah, so that's a really big question. So the book is interested in the idea of a post-work society. And there is a lot of debate around the idea of whether a post-work society would be a kind of post-capitalist society. Yeah, I mean, this is a really difficult question.
I mean, we've got a glimpse of what happens when you do that, right, in state plan economies. What would this post-work society look like?
I suppose it would be a society in which work was no longer essential to survival, no longer culturally central, no longer crucial for our kind of social status. And it would be a society in which there would be radically kind of reduced working hours. There would be a more even social distribution of work. So we no longer see this split between a kind of small core of people who are securely employed and then a big mass of people who are kind of, you know, in the gig economy or unemployed. And another important part of a post-work society would be the development, I guess, of an infrastructure of relationships and public spaces that would allow people to kind of be productive and do something useful with their free time, which takes things in quite a different direction from the way that they're going now.
Right now, we place a lot of social capital on hard work or a good work ethic, and we measure it in terms of productivity. So, but in this post-work society, what kinds of metrics can we use to evaluate a person's contribution to society?
I mean, I guess it's an argument for a different kind of value system where your worth isn't equated with your kind of productivity or contribution.
So the potential of an increasingly automated workforce, as you mentioned, provokes a lot of excitement as well as anxiety. Do you see this as an antidote to bring us closer to that post-work society, or is it a harbinger of something more dystopian?
Yeah, I guess the point I would make is that technology alone isn't the kind of decisive factor as to whether we end up in a kind of post-work utopia or some kind of dystopia where the machines have taken over and there are no jobs. For me, it's really a kind of political question of how we choose to use automation. Do we allow things to kind of continue as they are? Automation is kind of knocking people out of work. And the conventional response to this is to then kind of create more jobs, jobs which are often not very socially valuable and may contribute to environmental destruction. Or do we kind of step up and say that we're going to harness automation to more humane ends, to kind of give us more free time and to reduce the overall amount of work that there is to do? So I don't think technology alone really kind of decides the future. I think it's a kind of political question of how we choose to use that technology.
There's this essay by John Maynard Keynes who wrote that essay is titled Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren. And he predicted that exponential leaps in productivity will lead to more leisure time. He's assuming that people would choose to work less, but this, of course, did not turn out that way.
I think, you know, what Keynes overlooked, I mean, Keynes thought that by now we'd be working very short working weeks. But I think that what he overlooked is the tremendous capacity for capitalism to kind of reabsorb those savings in free time by kind of creating new forms of work, by increasing the amount of consumer goods that are produced, by commercializing activities that we used to do ourselves in the form of work. So I think Keynes overlooked the extent to which capitalism would kind of snatch back the free time saved through automation. Oh, just certainly the situation now is kind of very different from what he imagined.
But implied in Keynes' argument as well, I guess, of your book is that the antithesis of work, be it leisure or happiness, are superior. Is this not just as dogmatic as valuing hard work above everything else?
I think the point is not to kind of... I think that's a really good point. I think the point is not to kind of replace one dogma with another, not to kind of replace this kind of dogma of work with a dogma of leisure or a dogma of something else. I think what this is really about is kind of responding in a level-headed way to what I perceive to be a kind of crisis of work in modern society. So we've elevated work to this position where it's supposed to do all of these things, right? It's how we produce most of what we need, and it's how we earn an income and survive, and it's how we form our identities and live out our ambitions and make a social contribution. But on the other hand, we have this situation where we're seeing this huge rise in poor quality work and insecure work and the endurance of mass unemployment. And I think, you know, what the critique of work is about is kind of responding to this in a level-headed way and saying that we really need to rethink the place of work in society. Work is no longer working. It's no longer able to fulfill all of the social functions that we've assigned it. And I guess that's how I'd frame this argument. It's not about kind of replacing one ideology with another, replacing an ideology of work with an ideology of leisure, but it's about kind of responding in a kind of rational, humane way to this what people have called the crisis of work.
What is your biggest takeaway or learning from after finishing this book?
My biggest takeaway is that it's how difficult it is to kind of resist work on an individual basis. You know, people sometimes ask me if they should read the book. And what I always say to them is that it doesn't really include any answers about how to live. It doesn't really include any kind of, you know, lifestyle advice or advice about what choices people can make in relation to work. Because resisting work is a very difficult thing to do. And I think that's what the book really shed light on for me, is that if we really want to be able to resist work, that's something that needs to be done collectively. So the question I would ask is not, you know, how can we all work less and enjoy more free time, but can we come up with kind of collective guarantees that will allow everybody to work less and enjoy more free time? So maybe that's the takeaway, is that any kind of resistance to work has to be a collective and social thing, and not an individual thing. If it's just an individual thing, then it will be limited to people who have the resources to be able to resist work, which is kind of a luxury.
Thank you very much, David.
Thanks. Those are really interesting questions.
I've been speaking to David Frain, author of The Refusal of Work, Rethinking Post-Work Theory and Practice. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.